My name is Stuart Barry, and welcome to The Thinking Traveller. When we think of ancient Rome, we automatically think of the strong male characters, figures such as Caesar, Pompey, Augustus. But what about the women of ancient Rome? Recent study is starting to emphasise the agency that Roman women enjoyed. To help us understand what this newly researched area examines, we are joined by Dr. Catherine Welch. Catherine holds a PhD in Roman history from the University of Queensland, a BA and MA from the University of Sydney, and a Diploma of Languages in Latin from the University of New England. She taught Roman history for 30 years at the University of Sydney until her retirement in 2021, and since then has continued to lecture on Roman history and related topics in academic and general forums. Catherine's main field of research is the political and social history of Rome in the first century BCE, the era of Cicero, Julius Caesar, Pompey, and some very formidable and fascinating women. Hi, Catherine. Thanks for joining us today. What actual monument or site in Rome do you think best sums up the position of women in ancient Rome?
Well, that could take you on a little tour around Rome, in fact. There's so many intriguing statues in museums, and there's some very fine inscriptional material. But I'm going to take us a little way out of town, up the Appian Road, to the tomb of Caecilia Metella, because this, to me, is the most impressive monument with a woman's name on it. It's got a very clear inscription. It says, to Caecilia Metella, the daughter of Creticus, we know who he was, consul of 69, and the wife of Crassus, and we know who he was. He was the younger brother, or the younger son, of the famous Crassus, who teamed up with Caesar and Pompey. So we know the name. We don't know very much more about her. We know about her son, but she has this absolutely monumental tomb that sits on a hilltop and was a very favoured monument for the Romans to go for a walk to. And so when Sixtus V wanted to strip it of its marble, there was one monumental protest, and the monument was saved. And so we can still go and see this fantastic monument. But what's really interesting about it is how many scholars refuse to accept that it was a tomb for a woman and it was about her. They want to make it about a father. They want to make it about a husband. They want to make it about a son. They absolutely will not accept that it can be a really big tomb to a Roman woman. And yet that is what the inscription says it is. And I am going with the inscription.
So that obviously raises the question. So who would have paid for the tomb? And would women themselves be able to finance these things, or would their sons?
Yes.
Would
have- well, okay. It could be her. It could be that in her will, she would have said, I want this money spent on my tomb. She could have organised it in advance. Or, as one scholar has recently suggested, it could have been built by her son. So there's various possibilities, and we don't know. But what is really interesting, if it was by the son, and it could have been, he possibly had every reason to be grateful to her. If it was by the son could have put something in the inscription to say that he built it, so that he got some of the kudos for being so nice to his mum. And yet we don't get anything. We just get this, to Caecilia Metella, daughter of, wife of. So we don't know. And I think that's the simple answer, is we don't know. So we have to look at other tombs where it's very clear that women have set up their own tombs, or that people have set them up for them. Both of them are possible. Both of them suggest, however, that she was very important to whoever paid for it.
So you're saying that the women could have money in their own right, so they could decide how to spend it? It's not quite the image we have of the Roman Empire where the women were subservient.
Well, let's come to that subservience in a little while. I've got some words to say about that, but let's just think about women and money. So around Rome, there were a few other monuments, that some which we have and some which we don't. We do have the porticus of Octavia, who was Augustus's sister, and that is very impressive. What we can see today are the remains of this porticus as it was renovated in a couple of centuries later, and then it was turned into the fish market. And then come the new excavations in Rome in the late 19th, early 20th century, it was stripped back of some of its accoutrement, and the inscription was revealed, and the porticus of Octavia was put back into the streetscape in a new way, but it's still surrounded by the idea of the old fish markets in Rome. So we've got that. What we don't have, but we know about from records, is the Porticus of Livia, which would have been over on the Esquiline, close to Santa Maria Maggiore. So in that part of Rome, huge porticus, which was lavishly decorated and had her name on it. And so that would have been there for people to experience. It was right in the middle of where people lived. So that was another one. And little fun fact about it, which I really love, that Pliny tells us, Pliny the Elder, in discussing wine making, says that it had one almighty grapevine from which you could still get 12 amphora, I think it is, 12 amphora of good wine every year in Pliny's day. So 100 years after Livia's death, they're still making wine from the grapes they're harvesting from this public monument that she has her name on for the people of Rome that lived in that area. So there were quite a number of these spectacular monuments. And then we can go down to Pompeii and see the building of Eumachia, which clearly says sua pecunia, with her own money. With her own money. So it's absolutely specified that Eumachia paid for her own building with her name on it in big letters. It's very important evidence for what we're talking about today.
Yeah. So how did this compare to, say, women in England or France or Germany?
Okay, well, let's start with England. Until 1870, when a woman married, unless she set up a very specific marriage contract, everything she owned became the possession of her husband, absolutely everything. So it didn't matter. She could be the grandest heiress when she married. Every bit of property and all decisions about it transferred from her to her husband. That was until 1870, when we get the first Married Women's Property Act, which actually said a woman could keep control of her own inheritance. So there was no way an English woman could do what these Roman women could do. There's no doubt that their money was transferred unless, you know, some kind of prenuptial contract was set up. It was quite incredible. And the women of the time realized it. We've got wonderful documents. Well, they're not wonderful. They're quite distressing documents about comparing themselves to women that lived under codes in Europe that had more Roman law in them, and therefore there was more separation of property between a married woman's property in certain places in Europe and England. So they actually knew how disadvantaged they were under the law, and how even these marriage contracts in some cases could be got around so that husbands could get hold of their wives' property. And this, of course, was reinforced by law. It wasn't the wrong thing to do. It was the expected thing to do. But then when we go over to other countries, you do find that there's a separation. But in almost every circumstance that I've found anyway, husbands had the wife right to administer property. So even though it was kept separate and she might have some say in who inherited it, it was hers and she could know it was hers, she still couldn't do much with it because it came under his control. That's a little bit Roman and a little bit not, but more not, in fact, than a little. But that was the situation for pretty much every woman who married. If you didn't marry, there was a bit of a difference, but if you were married, your husband had pretty much control of your property in one way, shape, or form, England being the worst.
Would you be saying that women in ancient Rome were liberated?
Well, they were, so the term that gets bandied around is emancipated. And I'm not sure that a Roman woman would know what that meant. Okay, so were they liberated? Let's go back to what that meant for us in the 1960s. It meant, okay, that you removed those shackles that were, if you like, the residue of the position I just talked about, okay? Being able to own your own property, being able to decide what you wanted to do with your life, not being dependent on a husband. These were some of the things that lay behind what we called women's liberation. Also what you wore, because if you're confined in your clothing, there's a whole lot of stuff you can't do. So it had all of those resonances about freedom. Now, in that sense, no, Roman women were not liberated. But I put it to you that they also hadn't suffered to the same extent some of the things that women in the 1960s had suffered. And so therefore they would not perhaps in some circumstances they would feel this, but in a lot of circumstances they wouldn't have felt the same because they wouldn't have been as confined. So the trick is to know how they were confined and how that's different from how women of the 60s, who were all for women's liberation, what they felt they were being confined by. It's quite different. The context is quite different.
All right. So what do we see women doing in ancient Rome that we might not have seen them doing in early modern Europe or even in our own society until recently?
Or even in, a fair point. All right. So let's come back to a couple of more fun facts. If your father was alive, and this is males and females, you can do virtually nothing. Oh, well, not quite. Let me put that better. The father had power over your economic circumstances, males and females. For as long as a father lived, he held the purse strings. So you can't go talking around your money when it's actually your father's money. So your father kind of has to die in all of this, which, lifespans being what they are, a lot did, some didn't. But even with your father alive, it was expected, particularly among wealthy families, that every child of the household, male or female, would get a sum of money every month, every year, that would be theirs to spend. So the father holding the economic purse strings didn't necessarily mean you didn't have your own spending money. You just didn't control the big picture. He did. The father did that. And that spending money could be quite considerable. We have news of one woman actually financing her dowry out of her fatherly allowance. So you could kind of live a relatively independent life on the money that your father gave you. But obviously, he still has the mass of the wealth. Now, once he dies, for men and women, they are free of this paternal power. Nobody else holds it except a father. Unless you've been married by a sort of old-fashioned ceremony that meant you passed from your father's power into your husband's power. And then he held the purse strings. And he could decide how much money you got every month. But that wasn't the common form of marriage. The common form of marriage was basically that you moved in and you stayed within your father's household. So you stayed under fatherly power and you just lived with your husband. Roman marriage is really interesting because it never depended on a service or a celebrant or a state registration or anything. It just really, really meant moving in. And then personal ceremonies under this old-fashioned system, or just a party by the simple method. And that, of course, meant that divorce was as simple as moving out. So that's a big distinction. But to come back to money, so if you stayed under your father's power and he died and you were married, nothing changes. Nothing changes. So you inherit your share of the estate along with your brothers. You might not be heir, but you can inherit. And then basically, you don't have a father and you don't have a husband overseeing that property. Now that, of course, gives women a lot more freedom to move than going from paternal power to marital power and a husband administering your estate. Sounds too good to be true, doesn't it?
Well, it does. It certainly makes the single women very attractive, I suppose, for any prospective social climber. Yeah, gold digger. Yeah, reversed, the male gold digger. Yeah. So,
well, yes, except that marriage is totally separate property is totally separate between husband and wife. So apart from the dowry, which you would bring into a marriage, which a husband could use and was his for the length of the marriage, he doesn't get your property. So you don't get his, he doesn't get yours. The dowry, yes, because that's kind of your maintenance. But if there's a divorce, he has to give it back. So he can't just, get rid of it. He has to be able to give it back in the event of a breakdown. The catch for Roman women, and there was one, and it's an important one, was that because they were considered like weak and incapable, which everybody actually really knew wasn't true because they'd met these women, they were extremely capable, but because at law you were considered not capable, you had this tutor, this guardian, and he had to sign off. He had to give auctoritas if there's a transfer of property or a very specific set of actions you needed his permission to do. So it actually meant for these women, the real catch was, what kind of tutor did you have? And could you just tell him what to do and he signed off? or could he intervene and prevent you from managing your property? And that is the tricky bit for Roman women. If they could get around this tutela, this guardianship, which we think many could, then you were right, you were home and hosed. But if you were in a position where you had a tutor that had more power over you than was than you liked, then that was harder. So putting that proviso in there, if you could get around tutela, you could basically manage your property once your father was dead, whether you were married or single.
How common was divorce?
We think very, very common from what we anecdotally can pick up from the sources. Lots of people are divorced. There's an expectation that once a divorce occurs, that or even a death, that the surviving partner will remarry. In fact, under the Augustan marriage legislation, you were required to remarry because he was all about trying to get people, or the right people anyway, to have more children. So it was very common. And we know, for example, that Pompey the Great was married 5 times. Caesar's married 1, 2, depending on whether you count the first one, 3, 4, at least 4 times. So multiple marriages among the political class were common, very common. We even hear of one story, I have to tell you what, this is really quite fun, where one guy who wants to be really good friends with another guy says, let's have a child that is, you know, half brother, half sister. So I'll divorce you divorce your wife and I'll marry her. We'll have a baby together and then our children will be siblings.
Okay. That's getting a little bit bizarre.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough.
So obviously Roman women had a lot of freedom. How were they restricted? Obviously there must have been a lot more.
Well, I've already mentioned tutela. Yeah. And that is a restriction that seems not to be critical to a lot of women in, say, the period I study of the late Republic, early Empire. And it was actually abolished in the time of Claudius, but it stayed around and it did come back later. So tutela, guardianship, was important. But we do have a lot of other restrictions as well. So Roman women were citizens, but not voting citizens. So in terms of politics, they're restricted by the fact that they are not members of the voting community, and they certainly can't hold political office. So that is a restriction, a big one. They are restricted by a whole series of social processes that we need to unpack and understand the effect of. But most of all, I think they're restricted by the fact that this is still a very patrilineal, patriarchal society, for sure. Even with these measures of agency that I've been talking about, there are all sorts of ways in which they are restricted. And I guess the biggest one is that when they married, they produced children for that household, the household of their husband, and those children immediately became, once the father acknowledged them, they were under his power, same as I talked about at the beginning. And in the event of a divorce, a woman will have known that she will never get custody of those children, ever, because they are the children of her husband's household. That's how they're considered at Roman law. We kind of get the feeling in the sources that there was a lot of interaction between divorced women and their children that they left behind. So certainly, again, anecdotally, it looks like there remained a tremendous interaction and bond between mothers and children of former husbands. And in the event of a death, it was certainly expected that a mother would raise those children, whether she remarried or not. So the social practice could have ameliorated what the law prescribed, but we know what happens when we know over cross societies and all sorts of circumstances that when men have that power over their children and emotions are involved, as they no doubt will have been even in Rome, that was a critical factor. And I think we need to understand it as a critical factor.
Okay. You've said quite a few times about according to the sources, and the sources tell us a little bit. Well, what actual sources do we get this information from?
Well, okay. That's an interesting one. We get them from a variety of sources. So let's just start with the big narratives where you would not expect to find women, you know, all the war and conquest and all that sort of stuff. It is amazing how frequently women come into the story in these sources. Livy, the historian Livy, creates tremendous stories about women, and so do the sources writing in Greek. My favourite, Appian of Alexandria, has got plenty to say about women. So most of them, Tacitus has a lot to say about women in the imperial house, much of it not very complimentary, but they're certainly very, very, very present in his narrative, hugely present. I would suggest that pretty well all the standard narratives have them there somewhere, but we don't rely on them alone. So coming down to the late Republic, which is what I know best, the letters of Cicero are full of stories about women, full of references to them. His own wife, Terentia, is quite a character. She is very, very, very rich. And it's pretty clear that Terentia has a fair bit to do with Cicero's financial stability. So that's another thing. Marriages could be partnerships because women could choose to help their husband's political career. But we also have this vast number of inscriptions, and inscriptional evidence is key to little details, but also some quite remarkable stories. So they're the stories that deal with not famous individuals, so they're giving us a much better cross-reference, a cross-section of stories and details about women in ancient Rome. And of course, yeah, that's just in Rome. We go down to Pompeii and we've got a lot more evidence from there and from Herculaneum and from towns like Paestum and all sorts of contexts there where we see variations on the theme.
Right. You've obviously been talking about women in the upper class or well-off women or, you know, protected women. Well, what about for the lower classes? What about for less well-off or less protected women? What was life like for them, or what do we know?
In a way, it's the same story, but a different degree and perhaps a different way that a day would unfold. Here, I think, even when we deal with wealth, the big, big, big distinction ought to be, and we should acknowledge, that enslaved women didn't have any of these advantages. They were, I think, well, the luck of the draw was so terrible. You could not control your fate, either as a man or a woman, as when you were enslaved. So I think that's the first thing to note, that none of this will apply to a vast number of people who were enslaved. The interesting category is the liberated, in the real sense, liberated from slavery woman who was freed. And what is her status? Now, that's going to depend. And for her, it could actually be quite problematic. So if she's freed, every freed slave owed what the Romans called officium, that is duty, to their former owner. So they never quite got free of that person. That former owner became their patron, but whereas a freeborn person could move around different patrons, a freed slave was duty-bound by law to certain duties towards their patron. And one of the things that happened to a freed woman was that her patron was very often her guardian, her tutor. So when I said that tutelar could remain pretty awful for some women, freed women could suffer under tutelar because they owe this person a debt of gratitude, they owe this person a series of social expectations, and this person is also the only person who will act as their guardian. And if that person is not very nice, they've got a problem. Then, of course, what did happen from time to time is a freed woman might marry her former owner. This happened frequently. Now, sometimes we've got beautiful tombstones talking about the love between them and all of this sort of thing. So I'm not suggesting that these marriages might be unhappy. Many of them will not have been because it will have been a choice. But from the point of view of a woman who might decide she'd made a mistake, she doesn't really have very much comeback from that. And she's really got patron, guardian, husband. All these people can be rolled into one. So as my friend who's done a lot of work on this remarked, freedom from tutelar for such a woman would have been a very, very handy very handy law change in their regard. For the rest of them, I think we find women involved in industry. We find women involved in daily work. I think new studies are beginning to be more trenchant about the idea that they will have been out on the streets all the time doing whatever they did, that we've, in a way, we've erased women from our streets because we've not expected them to be there. But when we look at all the source material that we can with clear eyes, I think we find them running businesses, buying property, selling property, doing all kinds of things. Sometimes they needed a man to sign the paperwork, but they're there living life, living their lives to the level of their means.
Okay. Who's the most interesting Roman woman you've come across?
Well, everyone's going to expect me to say Livia, and I'm very happy to do a whole thing on her one time. She is actually deeply interesting, but I'm not going to say her this afternoon. I'm going to come back to one of these inscriptions that I mentioned and the stories about, in this case, an unknown woman. We don't know her name. We know a lot about her, but we don't know her name. Her story is preserved in a long inscription from the Augustan period, so moving into the first years of the Common Era. And this inscription is 100 lines of Latin that we've got. We're missing a bit. So an extensive story that records the funeral oration that her husband performed at her funeral. And then went and hammered the whole speech out on stone. Okay, so this is her story, and it tells the story through the period of upheaval and chaos and civil war, how, first of all, her parents were murdered, and she and her sister, because the men were out of town, brought the murderers to justice. Then she had to deal with some people claiming to be her tutors. She said they weren't. They were trying to steal her inheritance and that of her sister by trying to cut a deal with her, but she went back to court. And she got the magistrate to decide that, no, they weren't her guardians. So she had a right to carry out the terms of her father's will as he'd wanted it, which probably included marrying her to the fiancé because they were only betrothed at this point. She then has a whole lot of chaos in Rome that meant that she and the household had to defend the house against marauders. And then we go on to the fact that the husband, got himself into a whole lot of political hot water. And instead of letting him run away, which he wanted to do, they hid him. She and her sister and her sister's husband, the three of them hid him in the house and kept him safe through the turmoil, then got him pardoned. He was allowed to come out and just resume life again. So they saved his life. They saved his status. And then they lived together. They were married for 41 years. He says, without a quarrel. Well, I counted two in the stories itself, and one went her way and one went his way. So maybe he said without a quarrel, except it was even. I don't know. But, you know, I'm saying any of us that have been married for a long time, to say without a quarrel just means one person is dominant. So I kind of like the idea that there was some back and forwards going on here. And then at the end of the story, they couldn't have children. She offered to divorce him so that he could, you know, marry another wife and have children, and she would treat this wife as a sister. How the wife would feel about it, I don't know. But anyway, he says, no, I could never, ever, ever divorce the wife who saved my life and who is my life. Why would I trade? And this is one of the beautiful parts of the Latin. Why would I trade certain things for uncertain things? So he was happy with his wife that he couldn't have children with. He was sticking with her. And he says, and I am now completely broken. And so all this idea about Roman masculinity and subservience is just eradicated in this beautiful story of marital partnership and respect. Respect for her feistiness, respect for the fact that she was formidable, and respect for the fact that she was generous to her relatives and did all the right things. I mean, she could do the weaving, that's fine. Look at all the other things she was doing in her community. It's just such a great story. And so I think to think about the lives of Roman women, even through chaos, and their visibility and the gratitude that they earned when they supported their family, their community, their religious systems, all of these things you find women playing a role in, it's dramatically good reading.
Wow. What an amazing obituary. And
yes,
the hard work of chiseling it onto the stone for the stonemason.
I know. So and the money involved, don't you worry. To come back to the tomb, the money involved would have been considerable. He spent it.
So where was the tomb?
We don't know. The tomb was broken up and there were bits of this inscription all around Rome where, as I said, we're still missing some, but some were known from very early. And then in the early 20th century, I think, or the very late 19th century, they found more fragments and they knew from this exquisite writing, he didn't just get any cutter to do this. He got one of the best. It's immaculate. If you stand in front of it, there's a little bit of it in the Inscription Museum in Rome that I love taking people to. Oh, what can I do with a whole museum full of inscriptions in Latin? I stand them in front of that and I say, this is the story. All we can see of her name, which would have been there, it's just in a missing bit, it says Uxoris, of the wife. So the wife of, and of course it would have had his name there as well as the orator and the person who put the tomb up and got the inscription all chiseled out. But that lettering is so distinctive that it was possible to put the bits back together again for the most part. And as I said, we've got about 100 lines of Latin from a person whose name we don't know to a person whose name we don't know.
But an amazing story of an amazing woman.
Yeah.
Catherine, thank you. Thank you so very much for introducing us to some incredible Roman women, very much overlooked in the history of Rome, and you're changing it for us.
Can I add a little word as to
please
why?
Please do. Yeah, yeah.
And this is just something for us to think about when we study this stuff. Coming back to those women in England and Germany, and France, particularly France, after 1804 and under a dreadful, dreadful legal code for women. It wasn't so bad for men, but it was terrible for women. These are the guys that actually did the first work on our narratives of ancient Rome. And women meant so little to them that they took them out of the story, not the ancients. The ancients might have put them in a second-class category. They might have put some structural disadvantage in there. They did. This is very true. It's a patriarchal society. But they didn't erase them in the same way that some of these 19th century scholars did. So this is where my fight is at the moment, to try and bring our eyes back to the ancient text and study that context and try and get over our issues, which should all be about us today and how we see women in our society. That's where that all should come in. But for Roman women, let's go Roman.
Well, there's a good catch cry at the end. Let's all go Roman. Catherine,
for sure.
Thank you so very much. That was fascinating. We look forward to catching up with you soon.
You're very welcome.